Hello, it's the 29th of January. This is, I think, the 11th class, and I don't, we're definitely going to be finished by next class because we're starting a new series. I'm not going to be here in 3 weeks, so in theory, maybe I could finish today if I really push it, but definitely by next class. And then we're going to have at least definitely 1 week off. I'll be away, maybe more, I'm not sure yet. And then we're going to begin with a brand new series on the Mussar movement. And well, not really the Mussar movement per se, but the dispute over the Mussar movement. But of course, we'll need to understand what the Mussar movement was a bit before we start getting into that. Just a few things. First, we've had a number of signups for the Central Europe trip that, would, God willing, this summer, the early bird special ends the end of January. So if you want to sign up, now's the time to do it. If you not 100% sure, but you think you'll know soon, maybe they'll give you an extension. I can say, look, I understand that some people don't want to travel. It's this, unsure things in the world. I'm not so sure, but I can tell you that the safest place in the world is probably Hungary. You might not like the politics of the leader of it, but believe me, it's the safest place imaginable. A lot safer than New York and London and Paris and also the Czech Republic. But we we're going to live our lives, and we'd love for more some people to join us. So if you're interested, please come. Please sign up. I just mentioned to Naftali a new book that appeared. I'm holding it in my hand right now. Although it says, is it available yet? Yes, he's even showing on Amazon. Moshe Miller from Touro, Lander College, I guess, and I think Touro's Women's College, Samson Shon Raphael Hirsch's Religious Universalism and the German Jewish Quest for Emancipation. You got it for paperback, $34.95. I'm fortunate that I was sent the hardback. But it looks like a great book. It deals with really not just Hirsch, but the German Orthodox, how they're related to Christianity and the wider Jewish world, the wider non-Jewish world. A chapter on Rebecca Vettlinger, on Hildesheimer. It's very looks like a very a good book. Next, one of our listeners responded to a question. Someone asked, why didn't young Israel join the Synagogue Council of America? So I said, well, maybe it was an ideological thing. I wasn't really 100% sure, but one of our listeners, whose father was very involved in these sort of organizations and knows very well, he said the Synagogue Council of America could not have more than one lay organization or more than one rabbinic organization per movement. Otherwise, it would have changed the structure. Because he had reform rabbinic and reform lay, same the conservative and orthodox. So thank you for that, and that's good to know. And finally, he said, I have all these things I want to get to before we end the series. And this has been on my desk in the back there from this book, and I had to actually open it up to see what I had marked here. Remember, weeks ago we spoke about Rabbi Bamberger didn't want his writings to be published, and then the question went to Rabbi Tzolk'in Spector and the Netziv, and they ruled that yes, you can publish it. Well, Rav Pesach Frank, the same question came to him. If you look, this is in the book on him called Gaon HaRa'ah. It's these books are very heavy. In Israel now, they put out these biographies, but whatever it's the paper, I guess that's they're really heavy. And every rabbi gets a book, whether you're top level, major leagues like Rav Pesach Frank, and even the second and third level, they all get their own. They all get their own books. So incidentally, I just got the Art Scroll book on Ramnota Greenblatt. And that came out very quickly, but he was a one of a kind, I can tell you. So it's some great stories there. But if you look in this book on page on volume one, pages 219 to 220, the same issue came up. Rabbi Diskin, Yoshua Diskin from Brisk, who was in Eretz Yisrael, sort of shared the leadership, I guess, of the Ashkenazic Old Yishuv with Rav Shmuel Salanto. The Rav Diskin was much more extreme. The question was, his son wasn't printing the tshuvos. Now, why wasn't the son printing the tshuvos? The son reads the Rucham, I don't know. But the Beis Din, that is the Beis Din of Jerusalem, paskin that although the physical works, this is like a question of intellectual property, the physical works belong to the son. But the chiddushim in it apply to all of Klal Yisrael, and the son, Rav Yitzchak Rucham, cannot say that to someone else, you can't publish these writings. If you happen to have my father's writings, you can't publish it. It's actually this is exact opposite in American law. In American law, if someone, let's say someone wrote me a letter. I own the letter. The letter belongs to me, but I can't publish it without getting the approval of the person or the heirs. I guess I don't know how long you have to wait, but certainly when heirs are alive, I don't think after 200 years it's an issue. I'm not sure, but definitely you need to get that permission if you don't want to be sued. So that's that I think is worthy of note. Of course, again, this raises the issue which we spoke about, which I don't have a handle on it. I mean, if what they said is that the children of Rav Bamberger can publish it, even though he said not to, because and according to the Nitziv, even Rabbi Bamberger couldn't not publish it. But what do you mean? How can you tell someone if it's my tshuva and I don't feel it's correct? I don't feel it's proper. I put forth some ideas, but I'm not convinced of it. And I say I don't want it to be published because of that. How can you say I'm obligated to be public to publish it? So the Nitziv might say, "Well, you're only saying it because you're modest, and therefore we don't have to pay attention to your modesty. It's still Torah." But who says? Maybe I really am not sure of the conclusion. I mean, there is right now in Lakewood, New Jersey. And I've confirmed this, by the way. I mean, there's a lot of people have written about it, but I've confirmed it. There is a responsum, a tshuva of Rav Aaron Cutler, explaining that you can rely on the heter mechira, the sale of the land during a sabbatical year, that which only those tzionim, rachmanu litzlan, they rely on the heter mechira. Everyone knows that good charedim from Lakewood would never dream of relying on the heter mechira. And it's not just charedim in Lakewood. I've seen in one in particular, modern Orthodox synagogue that had a sign in it saying all the products you cannot buy from Israel. It's like BDS. This is in a modern Orthodox synagogue saying don't buy from these products. But the point is, so Rav Aaron Cutler wrote this, and the family refuses to publish it. So are they? Is that improper? If I had a copy of it, am I allowed to publish it? Apparently, Rivaro never published it. Apparently, he didn't want to. Whether maybe because he thought it was too political, or maybe he wasn't convinced in the correctness of his idea. So, are we saying now that the one who writes it and the children have no authority whatsoever? Certainly, the one who writes it, I would think. So, I find it a bit problematic what the Nitziv wrote, but. At other times, you can understand that it's not just about modesty, and there's a political angle, and I think it's fair to ignore it. So, for instance, here's a sefer called Hilchos Medina. It was published in the early 50s by Rav Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, known as the Tzitz Eliezer, one of the great poskim in the second half of the 20th century. Well, when the state was declared, he published three volumes called Hilchos Medina, all the questions about halacha in a modern state. And you can see how much he loves, he thinks this is the greatest miracle that God, after the Holocaust, has given us a state. Sounds very, very Zionistic. And it's great volume with all the issues. He had a son, as far as I know, just one son, who became a dayan on the Eidah Charedis. He actually predeceased Rav Eliezer Waldenberg. His name was Simcha Waldenberg. And he had children, of course. So the children were obviously in a very different world. And they never wanted the book to be reprinted. In fact, Rav Waldenberg himself didn't reprint it. Not sure if he just didn't, or he had a reason not to, because he knew where his grandchildren and children, son, what community they were in. But so right after the passing of the Tzitz Eliezer, this book was reprinted 30 days, within 30 days after his passing. And the reason given is because the children, they said the grandchildren will never reprint it because they don't believe in this sort of Zionistic halacha. And therefore, so there was a whole article I remember that came out after this where the family was very upset. They said, you have no right to reprint it. And the person who reprinted it was quoted as saying, well, you're right. If you would reprint it, I wouldn't have a right. But since you're never going to print it, then you say you're never going to print it. I refuse to let this look at all of my volumes. I mean, how many pages? I refuse to let such great Torah from the great Posseger of Waldenberg just disappear, and therefore I'm going to print it because you refuse to. I think in a case like that, we can agree that the children, the grandchildren, for those sorts of reasons, they don't have the right to say that Klal Yisrael should not benefit from this. And that's what it records in the Sefer here. I mentioned over to Pesach Frank that the Beis Din Paskin, that the Rav Yitzchak Yeruchim, even though it's his father, he can't say that Klal Yisrael can't get the tshuvos. Again, as in American law, they absolutely would be able to say that, but we're talking Jewish law here.
Okay.
There's one more thing I need to finish up with, and we were in the middle of doing it with the whole Oustrich controversy. I was elaborating on Tzvi Yehuda Cook, and I called it the myth he invented, because he did. He created this whole myth of how of the dispute between Bamberger and Hirsch and all sorts of other things that weren't true. But it's fascinating still to see how Tzvi Yehuda, in his reconstruction and his myth making, he portrays the ideological origins. Where does Hirsch come up with this notion of Austrit, of separatism? It's only due because he, unlike Bamberger, he is so Tzvi Yehuda was acculturated, let's say, assimilated, whatever you want to say. He's so much a part of German culture that he absorbed the impure German culture. And that's what led into this idea. Now, you have to make a little jump here. Fine. Let's assume that Hirsch has absorbed the impure German culture. How then does that lead you to separatism? What does German culture have to do with separatism? It doesn't seem to have a connection. And, if you recall, Hirsch's point was, it's precisely us who are Torim Derech Eretz Jews who understand how vital it is. We're sophisticated. We know how we have to separate from Reform, because even in what you might think innocuous connections, getting together with the Reform rabbi to talk about the cemetery, that's not going to have any negative consequences. Hirsch's point was that no, we know it'll have bad consequences. Just sitting with them and talking about these matters is going to influence them. But Tzvi Yehuda sees the whole idea of Austrit as a sign of like an assimilation, a retreat from true Torah values, and the fact that Austrit emanated from the German impurity, from where Nazism also developed, shows that this ideology is rotten to the core, born in sin, as it were. Tzvi Yehuda connects. Germany is the most impure country in the world. Haraya, what's the proof? That's where Nazism comes from. And the fact that Hirsch was so enamored by this civilization, therefore we can attribute his ideology of Austrit to also the negative, impure German environment. Again, I asked the question last week, what about Hungary? Hungary, they also have this Austrit idea. But that's what Tzvi Yehuda says. Now, one of Tzvi Yehuda's students, you can see him online. He has many shiurim. His name is Yosef Kellner or Kalner. He teaches at this place, Eili. There's a mechina where the students go before they go to the army in Eili. And a lot of Americans go there, actually. And I was speaking to one of the Rosh Yeshiva in Israel of the yeshivas that students from America go to. And he said, it's an amazing thing because this place, Eili, is hard chardal. And it's what they call the kav. There are two types of chardal. The chardal that are like, are the state can do no harm, anything like that. Not the Merkaz, Harav chardal, but the other type of chardal, Rav Tao's version. And, he said to me that it's amazing that Americans send their kids there and then they're indoctrinated into this hardcore chardali, ideology. And, there's a rabbi there named Levenstein who said some strange stuff about gays. And in any event, Yosef Kalner happens to be an expert in Rav Kook. He's the one who came out, he published the Mafteach of like all the ideas of Rav Kook and where to find them. Very important for the book I did. But he goes so far as to say I hate to say this, actually. It's almost like I feel I need to do Kriya when I say this, but this is what he says. What can I say? He says the negative effects of Hirsch's ruling on Auschwitz were such that forgiveness could only be found through Pur'anutakal, Pur'anutakal, that is punishment of the Kakal, and that's the Holocaust. That is, Auschwitz was such a terrible thing, and that the punishment in order to us to be made pure, I guess, again, is, such a punishment. It began in Germany and it ends in Germany. I mean, how people could talk like this, I don't know, but that's what he says. It just gives you a sense of the, and all the sources, if you want to see them, are in my article that I mentioned last week. But this gives you a sense of how Rav Tzvi Yehuda saw the whole Hirschian approach is not just Golos mentality, but in opposition to the whole notion of Klal Yisrael as a people. He portrays Hirsch as just Judaism is just a religion. It's a denomination. So therefore, these people are not Orthodox. They're out. He doesn't understand. Rav Tzvi Yehuda says that we're a nation. We're a people. And of course, there's religious aspects, but you can't divide the people. Okay, so AdCon, until now, we Auschwitz. It took us four or five classes, but I think we learned a lot, and it's very relevant. It continues to be relevant. Whatever side you're on, you have important figures, important authorities. We also saw earlier that Bamberger opposed the Hirschian Torah Derech Eretz. He says he doesn't oppose secular studies, but he doesn't agree with Hirsch's idea of Torah Derech Eretz, which, look, Derech Eretz for Hirsch is almost like a divine revelation, the wisdom of the nations, that sort of thing. But we also saw that Bamberger did believe in secular studies. And I gave examples of that. I'll go further. I'll give you another one. Rabbi Bamberger published a sefer. There's a medieval Spanish sage called the Rav Yitzhak or Maariz Giat. That's how it's pronounced. Rabbi Bamberger published his halachic work. He called it, oh, I have a title page here. Hold on a second. I pulled it up for here. So it's early halachot and by Rav Yitzhak and Rav Yehuda Ibn Giat. He called the sefer Shaarei Simcha. Well, the sefer doesn't have a name. That's the thing. Sometimes you don't have names. Sometimes the Rishonim gave great titles, and you have to figure it out. And other times, there's a sefer, a medieval French sefer called Sefer HaNayar, just a book of paper. That's I don't know why I called it that, but that's how it's termed. Actually, it was edited. If anyone knows the late Rabbi Gershon Appel. He did this as his project at I guess at YU, a DHL, or I think it was, or something when he was at Yitzchak Elkanah. And then he went to he was rabbi in Seattle, and then he becomes rabbi in I think it's Worcester, yeah. And while there, he goes to Harvard and gets a PhD. He wrote a PhD on the Sefer Achinuch, but so they didn't have a title to this. So it was published by Rabbi Bamberger's son, actually. It says on the bottom, Simcha Alevi. He had many sons. And so therefore, he called it Shaarei Simcha. But more than that, however, quite interesting, that's the whole sefer together, both the Yitzhak Ibn Giat and also the commentary on him by Rabbi Bamberger called Yitzhak Yerani. But what did he call the just the Torah of Rabbi Yitzchak Ibn Giat? In other words, Shaarei Simcha is everything. The Torah of the Rishon and also Rabbi Bamberger's commentary. He called it Mea Shaarim. Now, why did he call it Mea Shaarim? If you look in the introduction, he tells you. Again, he says that it's a great story. He says that, he says, I thought, what to call this sefer? He says, on Sukkos. He says, he writes that he was sitting with his wife in the Sukkah and, they were talking, husband and wife were talking about, I guess he's working on the sefer, Ritzkiyat, and what name to give it. And this is what he says. This is part, he's writing it to his son who published the book. He said, as we're speaking, Imcha, your mother, the wise one, she heard what I was saying and the different opinions, and then she said as follows, Ishi, my husband. Yadati gam yadati. I know. She'ein b'melechas hanashim chachmas haTorah v'lo me'umnasan chaker halacha. She says, I know that as a woman, you know, that's not our place to be studying halacha. That's not what we do. Well, you know, this is a 19th century a woman speaking. Today it would be different, of course, in many circles. But she says, but since, you know, we're speaking about it, what does she say? She goes on. She says, his name is Yitzhak, right? So therefore, she called attention to this pasuk. Vayizra Yitzhak, this is in Bereishis 26, 12. It says about Yitzhak, that Yitzhak, you know, sold in the land. Vayimsa b'shanahi mea sharim. He found, how do we translate it here? He found in the same year 100-fold, not 100 gates, 100-fold, that, you know, God blessed him with that. So she, the wife, suggests that you should name the Sefer Mea Shearim. And, what does he say? Shamanu Dvarim Eila, I heard this. Speaking in the we, Vayismach Ledenu, and we, you know, we were so happy. V'tagadav Shenu. And then I said to my wife, you spoken well, my wife. Zeshmo hanalo, zeshmo asher yikarulo, v'halu b'sharecha masecha. So here you have the name of the Sefer that he gave it. Everyone today knows it as the Mea Shearim, was given by the wife of Rav Zalman Baer Bamberger. I think that's a very, very nice story he tells us. Well, so why do I mention this? Because in the introduction to the Sefer, he has a whole scholarly introduction, the sort of introduction, by the way, that only people who have like a, he never officially went to university, but you could see that he was an autodidact. He knew how to write like in an academic vein. He talks about, you know, with a book, where it comes from, that, you know, all the things that the academics write. And he says, in speaking about the Marisky, he talks about how he had great secular knowledge. And he sees this as a positive thing. We would say it was shvach, not a gnai. It's a positive thing. So we see he's not opposed to secular studies. For heaven's sakes, no one who lives in Germany in the 19th century could be opposed to secular studies. You couldn't live. It's like saying you live in America and you don't believe in speaking. You don't know English. I mean, you have to, he understood what he just, he didn't have the same approach as Hildesheimer, that everyone needs to have a doctorate. Or here, this romantic understanding of, you know, the wisdom of the world. But to be educated, to be a good citizen, to be able to conduct yourself in 19th century Germany, of course you need to have a good education for that. And he hired private tutors for his children for that very reason. They didn't go to the university, his children. I don't know if he opposed it, but they didn't go. He hired tutors. Incidentally, This Sefer, the Shari Simcha, which he has his, the Mea Shearim, Shari Simcha, it's called the Shari Simcha, which has his notes. So he deals with all the different shitas. He has a couple interesting shitas there that I just want to call your attention to. If you look in well, the old edition, pages 69 to 70, there's a new edition. I bought the new edition. I have it in Scranton, but you can see it in Otzer HaChachma. If you look there in the laws of Kriya, tearing for an Avel, he also deals with, he says, he deals with tearing Kriya. If you see the Beis HaMikdash, in its destruction, or Jerusalem and the cities of Yehuda in their destruction. And then he brings a brisa. This is Ritzkiyat brings a brisa, which we don't know. We have no other record of this brisa anywhere. But this is what it says. Tanya, Hamisyare Likroa al Yushalayim, Eno Rishai Likroa. If you're afraid, whatever that means, to tear your garment over Jerusalem, you're not allowed to. That is, first of all, we don't know where he got this brisa from and what does it mean? And, he says, Sarachiyu namakom alperish brisa zo. What does it mean? No one seems to, a number of people have discussed this, but no one's able to explain what it means. I'm thinking maybe, I thought maybe if it's talking about during the days when people lived in Yerushalayim and you see the destruction there and you're afraid because maybe the Romans would punish you if you did it. And therefore, since you're afraid to, you can't even secretly do it because you always have the fear and your mind won't be on what you're doing. That's what I'm thinking, perhaps. There's a, I mean, he quotes there, Rabbi Bamberger quotes, the Gemara says that you decree on Churban HaBayis, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara says, Echad HaShomea v'Echad HaRoeh, the one who hears about it and one who sees it. So what does it mean, hears about it? So that's Rabbi Bamberger says. That's referring to the days of the Churban HaBayis itself. When you were, this is a very old brisa going all the way back. So you heard about it. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Then you would do kriya, but that doesn't apply anymore. So that's why I made the connection that maybe that's what it means when it says that if you're afraid to do kriya. Then he had another interesting thing. I'll just share one more interesting thing there that he deals with. Why don't we say hallel on Purim? So there's two reasons given. One is that the Megillah takes the place of Hallel, and then there is a another reason given that that we're still considered. The Gemara said that we're still that they didn't declare Hallel because they were still avadim. That is, they still were slaves of Achashverosh. So it wasn't a complete I guess freedom. So Rabbi Bamberger, in his commentary there, discusses the difference. What's the practical implications, nafka mina, of the two opinions? And he brings the Meiri that according to the Rav Nachman's opinion, that Megillah is hollow. What do you do? The Meiri says that if you don't have a Megillah, let's say you're somewhere and you don't have a Megillah, then you're supposed to say hollow on Purim. And this chiddush is mentioned by some others. Rav Yonah Emanuel, in a review of this book, he points out that Rabbi Bamberger says that he explains that fine, although the Gemara tells us you're not supposed to do, read Hallel all the time, and that's the reason. Korah Hallel b'chol yom. People say you can't say Hallel on Yom HaTzmud or other times because the Gemara says you're not supposed to say a lot of Hallel. Here we see here that hollow without a bra that you would say hollow without a bracha on because the Meiri says that you would say if you don't have Megillah you say hollow without a bracha, and the Meiri says you don't have to worry about extra hollows that create a problem. Emmanuel says this is obviously relevant today. Yom HaTzmaut, Yom Yerushalayim. It's what's the difference? It's the same idea that you can add on Hallel for times. By the way, I after the 6 Day War, there was a great Rav. He passed away a few years ago. His name was Rav Saraya. What's his name? It's a Jewish name, but it's not a very common name. Deblitzky. He's a big Mekubal too from Bnei Brak. He didn't have a beard. He had a little beard, I should say. He said that although he's in the Haredi world, he understood the significance of the State of Israel and the 67 war. He says it's an Olam Hafuch. It's like a backwards world. He says usually you think of people when the more frum they are, they're the ones who want to do a lot of davening and a lot of prayers and everything. He says when it comes to anything having to do with the State of Israel, it's just the opposite. The people who we think of as quote the most frum. Chas v'shalom to say a prayer for the state, to say a prayer for the soldiers, to say a mishaberach, anything. Then all of a sudden, then you can't add more prayers. Otherwise, all the prayers you want to do, that's the best thing to do. But now they're like, you call them a kamtzon, that you can't say an extra prayer, chas v'shalom. So he pointed that out. Okay, I want to now pick up with some interesting things that Rabbi Humberger mentions in his biography. This will take us a bit further. It of he has a nice biography, if I can find it. Ah, yes, Rabbi Bamberger. At the end of they put out two volumes, Kol Kitvei, the collected writings of Rabbi Bamberger, not or Kitvei Rabbi. Is it? I forget what it's called because it's not all the writings. There's a number of other ones, but he has a nice biography. He calls him the Si HaLeviim, the Prince of the Levites. And he calls attention to a couple of interesting things. First of all, he mentions that he tells some stories about how Rabbi Bamberger was, how he tried to leave his community. And so that they do not go what he thought in the wrong path. So for and he gives a few examples of this, and he made takanot to prevent them from ordinances from doing things. So for instance, there's a common practice. I don't know if you know this. We have some Hungarians here. And this is like standard, I think, in every, they don't do it today. You come with me this summer to Budapest. We'll go to the Kaczynski show, which is like, it's like going back into 19th century Hungary. You got to see this to believe it. Forget all the oats roast. I was there one Shabbos where they're doing all the oats roast, but, it's just, you can see when you're there why we saw this, or Ray Kelman remembers this, why they needed some sort of modern orthodoxy. They still, but the practice in Hungary was, that you don't daven shacharis early, 6:30 a.m. Let's say you finish after Torah reading, you finish Kriyas HaTorah, and then you would then you'd have a break. You'd have a break like for an hour and a half. You'd have kiddush, you'd go home, and then you come back to Musaf for Musaf. Now we did this when I was in Camp Morasha. That's what we did. I thought that was just, and the reason we did it is because with little kids, you want to take them, give them something to eat, and they go back to Musaf. But that's what all the communities did. And I have yet to find a lot of tshuvos discuss it. Sometimes the rabbis were opposed to it, but that was the minhag. Other times they justify it. Why they ever came to this, I don't understand. I don't know why. And it bothers me to know when some shuls do this on Rosh Hashanah, right before Ketigas HaShofar, because then you go and you eat and you schmooze and they tell Lashon Hara and then you sort of you do it after Ketigas HaShofar. It's just, but then you can't talk. So I guess you can't. But why? What do we? Rav Henkin was very opposed to this, and Rav Gifter defended it. He said that's what we did
They
in the
used
yeshivas.
to do it. They used to do it because at that time the Baal Tokea and Baal Musaf used to go to the mikveh.
Yes, that's why they did that.
It
And
was
that's why I
shura.
was at a show where the rabbi went, and that's. But that's not why they did it. Why they waited Shabbos morning in Hungary. I don't know why they did. So lo and behold, Rabbi Hamburger tells us, this has been the back on page 532, that there were people in his shul. Obviously, they maybe went on vacation Hungary, and they liked this idea. Look, you could also maybe have learning, whatever it is. And he, they wanted to have an hour between Shacharis and Musaf so they could eat. And what did he say? Lo ratzon Rabbeinu. He refused to go along with this. And they give other examples. He gives other examples. He also mentions on this page how they're one of the communities in his district. I guess Kissingen, that's it must be his district. He what the way Hamburger writes it, he says that there was an Ezras Nashim without a Machitza. And when Rabbi Bamberger heard about this, he immediately ordered that they have to put a machitza in. And when they didn't listen, he got the government to get involved. Now, what he means here, and I went back to the original some time ago, I went back in the newspaper. He doesn't mean there was no machitza like we think of. I mean, there wasn't such a concept of machitza like we think of. In Germany, men and women didn't have, there was no machitza in a shul. The women were up in the gallery. So what he means is the German practice was, and this is the halacha as they saw it. This is based on the Rambam in the Parish of Mishnah. It's like the Satmar Rebbe also that you could not see the women, so that's what it should be the mechitza. So you, the women in the gallery, there was lattice work, and you come again this summer, you'll see this lattice work that so when the women stand, if they're tall, you're fine, you can see them over, but when they're sitting, you can't see them because there's in the gallery, there's lattice work where they didn't, and we don't have it in American shuls, as far as I know, that have galleries. But this is what they used to do. And if you go to the Kaczynski shul, you'll see that they have the lattice work. So in Kissingen, the women were upstairs, but there was no lattice work. So that's what he insisted. Then Rav Israel Hildesheimer, in his defense of some of the things he did against the extremists in Hungary, he acknowledges that certain things the extremists in Hungary said were correct. So, for instance, they're wrong to say you can't have a choir in shul. That's what the extremists there said. But he agrees with them that when it comes to the mechitza, you shouldn't be able to see the women. This was the big dispute between Ramosha Feinstein and Satmar Rebbe, because in Lithuania, they never understood this way. And if you look in the Mishnah Torah, the reason for the mechitza is so it is not intermingling. So whatever, however many feet you want to have it, 4 feet, 5 feet, whatever, then there's no mingling. But it has nothing to do with seeing. But in the Parash Mishnah, the Rambam has seeing. Normally, if it's a dispute between the Parash Mishnah and the Mishnah, we don't pay mind to the Parash Mishnah. But the Satmar Rebbe held that, I guess, I forget exactly his lashon, but it's, we could say, Lav Dafka in the Mishnah Torah, that you can't see. And that's that was in Hungary as well. Of course, in Würzburg, like in every city, there was an Erev. You needed an Erev. In those days, people, they kept the hot food, the chamin, the cholent, whatever you want to call it. They would keep it in the communal ovens, and therefore you had to carry to go to bring it there. And it was easy in the olden days because you had walled cities. People were inside the wall, and you had to work it out with the government, so you had to pay them a little something to, quote, rent it. When the walls start coming down and people start moving out, it becomes more complicated. And there was a whole case Rabbi Bomberger was involved in. You can read all about it. Adam Mintz, who I guess he's the expert on Erevin from a historical sense. He wrote a book on it. You can listen. He spoke for Torah in Motion a couple months ago. He spoke about Erevin in America and Canada. I think the first class was about general history. I don't remember, but he spoke about St. Louis Erev. The New York Erev, maybe he was, and then two New York Erev, he writes in the book.
Intro,
I don't know on the
intro
classes.
St. Louis, Toronto, and New York, I believe.
Okay, but the New York, he was talking about the modern Erev or the first Erev?
Yeah, I think he talked about the whole history, if I remember correctly.
Both. Okay, because in the book, he's two separate chapters. The first Erev on the Lower East Side, and so he published a book also. There was something at the Yeshiva University Museum, yeah. It was an exhibition called It's a Thin Line, the Erev and Jewish Community in New York and Beyond. So they even have an article by Reshechter about Erev. But you have an article here, The German Century and the History of the Erev, and a whole piece about Rabbi Bomberger and his. See, the problem is they had to, now that the wall came down, there are certain things that they needed to make an Erev. And they need the city to agree with, and the city refused to. And it doesn't seem to be anti-Semitism. It just seems to be that the city thought that this is insane. We're not making any changes because you have some crazy custom. Believe it or not, Rabbi Bomberger had to write to the King of Bavaria, who gave the ruling, let the Jews have their Erev. It's not really such a big deal for the changes they want. And that's why you were able to have an Erev in Würzburg, even when the city walls came down and it became more complicated. But all was not smooth for Bomberger and Würzburg. Today we think of these Gedolim and how, of course, we'd give anything if we could have people like that in our community. But I think I mentioned already, as the Maimar of the New Testament has it, it's often quoted as a Maimar Chazal. Even the Chasam Sofer quotes it. Ein Navi Be'iro. There is no prophet in his own town, but it doesn't appear in anywhere in Chazal. It's in the New Testament, and often when you're with people, you don't recognize them the way you should, and it's only when they're no longer with us we do. And Rabbi Bomberger describes, Rabbi Bomberger describes the case that Rabbi Bomberger battled with his community. The community wanted a choir. Now, what's wrong with a choir? In Hungary, you can't have a choir. That's considered assimilation. That's forbidden. If you want to be an Orthodox Jew, you can't have a choir. But in Germany, what's wrong with having a choir? Bomberger did not oppose the idea of a choir. The problem with the choir was that they were going to repeat words in the davening. And he wrote to Hirsch about this. And I don't know. I can't really determine. Is the issue so much the choir or the chazan? Because after all, the choir is sort of just like extra. The chazan with the choir repeating words is a problem. I don't know if it was just the choir repeating the words, as long as the chazan, like if the, in like we used to do growing up in Kedusha. Like if the chazan will just go hum along while the choir repeats the words, maybe it won't be a problem. But whatever, that he describes it as the repeating of the words. And the government, what does the government have to do with it? But you can't open a synagogue, and without the ruling of the government, if the government says that what you're doing is inappropriate, you have to listen to them. Now, granted, you can always try to avoid it, but in Germany especially, they were good citizens. If the government said something, they would listen to it. And they were able to get the government to write a letter to the community leader saying that if Bamberger does not approve the choir, you have no right to have a choir. And I don't know how that could be enforced. Maybe the government would fine them, whatever, but that's what he did. Later, they did have a choir. So presumably they didn't repeat the words, they went along with him. But at the beginning, this was an issue. Now, what's the problem repeating words? Okay, that's, Ramosha doesn't have such a problem repeating words, as long as it's not Hashem's name and as long as you're not skipping around. It's like the Kedusha we say in Musaf, where Kavod, Kavodo, Male, Male, Oh, Ayeme, Kom, Kavodo. I still remember as a kid, they would sing that. So from a Moshe standpoint, it's not really a problem, Kavodo, Male, Male. The problem is you skip the whole middle. And the Aruch HaShulchan is also Melamed Zchus, but no one, not Ramosha, not the Aruch HaShulchan, no one really likes this. And when you have, and sometimes it's actually forbidden halachically, but that's what people would do. And the Chazanim like this, so it's today it's pretty much gone out of style. It's very uncommon today to find in Kedusha. Any the Chazans have been, the rabbis have won for many, many. The Rav in the 50s wrote a letter to the Cantorial Association, whatever it is, there was a whole Cantorial Association in which he says you can't repeat words, but no one listened. I don't know, when I turned to more, I guess, punctiliousness in halacha, maybe in the 80s and on, then it became unacceptable to repeat words in Kedusha and Hallel, things, so all the Chazanim had to get into line. Occasionally, you'll get a chazan, he comes, he doesn't know, or he hasn't been with the times, and he'll repeat words. So what do you do? But generally, it's not really a problem today. So we see that Rav Bamberger, like I said, he had no issue with a choir per se. Now, granted, Jews didn't have a choir up until then, but it's what's wrong with it? It makes the service more beautiful. It's not really taken from the Christians. If Christians can have choir, but so what? If it has a good reason, it's not Chukos Hagayim. And Rav Bamberger is really no different in this than Hirsch, than Hildesheim, or any of the other German rabbis. They all agreed that just like our rabbis in America, they preach in English, they wear Western suits, all the same sort of thing. In fact, Rabbi Bamberger, it might surprise you, because so far we've seen Rabbi Bamberger is the old-fashioned Rav, Hirsch is the more modern Rav, Rabbi Bamberger is the Posek, the Lamden. Rav Bamberger wore the rabbinic gown. What do they call it? The Taller? I mean, he wore that gown, and that gown comes from the Christians. Absolutely. The Mate Levi has a tshuva, Mordechai Horovitz, and says, absolutely, this gown we wear comes from the non-Jews. But we know we could take things from the non-Jews if they have a good reason. We're not trying to imitate them for religious reasons. It's simply, this is a garb. It's like we spoke already years ago. You probably remember we spoke in this class about university gowns and things. So he wore a rabbinic gown. Let me read you what Hamburger says before I tell you about. Well, actually, let me just read you from eyewitness testimony or eyewitness repeating an eyewitness testimony. There was a rabbi. He was the rabbi in Altona, Hamburg. His name was Rabbi Joseph Karlbach. He had also a number of children who survived the war. One was Julius Karlbach, another was Miriam Gellis Karlbach in Israel. And Karlbach is, of course, a big family. The German, we say that German rabbis are the ABCs. The A's are the Auerbachs, B are the Bambergers, and C are Karlbachs, because each one of these families had loads of rabbis. And Joseph Karlbach, he's one of the only big rabbis in Germany who did not leave. He remained with his community, and he died in the Holocaust. I hate to say it, because I don't want to be the one who always says, sometimes people write that he remained with his community, with the implication that all the other rabbis who didn't remain, that we should judge them negatively. I don't want to say that at all. He did remain with his community. I personally asked Rabbi Dr. Alexander Altman. He leaves, I think it's October of 38, before Kristallnacht, I believe, and he leaves and he comes to England. He becomes the communal rabbi in Manchester. I asked him, I was a youth, so I had chutzpah. I said to him, how could you leave your community? He had maybe the biggest show in Berlin. Is the rabbi supposed to stay, go down with the ship, but be with the community? Rav Moshe Feinstein, we know that when he came to America, this is recorded by the children, that he was nervous that people looked down on him, that he abandoned his community. But he said that when he could no longer teach his children Torah, you go before everyone else. He had to leave. So Altman said to me, he said that by the end of 1938, anyone who could get out was getting out. And there's no longer was this notion that the rabbi had to stay with the community, because everyone was trying to get out if they could. That's what he told me. And he survived because of that. Well, Rabbi Karlbach told the following story, that he went to Eretz Yisrael. It does give a year. He says he paid a visit. There's a whole translation of it by Schneer Lyman in Tradition a number of years ago. You can see it on his website. He told the story that he paid a visit to Rabbi Salant when Rabbi Shul Salant was in his 90s. So the first decade of the or so of the 20th century. And he happened to mention Rabbi Bomberger, the great Rav of Würzburg. And he saw that Rabbi Salant was very impressed. There was a great bond. And, Rabbi Bomberger was in charge of the monies that would be collected in Germany for Eretz Yisrael. There was different organizations, Kollelim, and it was called the German-Dutch-Palestine Fund Committee. And they distributed money to Jews of German or Dutch origin. And Rabbi Shmuel Salant, he describes, didn't like this policy, where the Hungarians give to their kollel and the Americans give to theirs. He wanted to change it, because when the money came in, he was in charge of the money. He wanted to make it that it was just, forget these kollels. Now everyone's coming. It's one yeshuv. Let's just give money to everyone, however we determine it. So he actually traveled to Germany, to Würzburg. The only time Rav Shmuel Salant left the land of Israel, once he came, he was the unofficial chief rabbi for the Ashkenazim, and he travels to Würzburg, and he meets Rabbi Bomberger. And this is what Rabbi Karlbach reports, the account that Rabbi Shmuel Salant gives. Quote, "When I entered the synagogue," namely the synagogue in Würzburg, "I saw Rabbi Zalman Ber Bamberger standing there in Christian-like clerical vestments." Some of you also might have seen pictures of the old reverends in England, not just the reverends, even some of the rabbis. If you look in the Encyclopedia Judaica, there's a picture in there of Reverend Abraham Cohen, editor of the Sansino Books of the Bible, even published his own Torah, which is only traditional commentaries, not like the Hertz. And he's in with the dog collar. He looks like an Episcopalian minister. That's how they dressed. So he says that he saw him in the Christian-like clerical vestments. "I further noticed that, contrary to halachic requirements, the Al-Maimar," that is the Bima, "stood directly in front of the Holy Ark instead of in the middle of the synagogue." So in Rabbi Bomberger's shul, the Bima is not in the middle. It's in the front. The Hungarian rabbi said you can't even enter a shul, that the Bima is not in the middle. Rav Moshe was asked about this, and Rav Moshe said that that was only when there was a reform problem, and that's today it's not an issue. And but that's not what they thought. They thought this was really real halacha. And Rabbi Salant says, "Against the halacha, I was astonished." You can imagine he's astonished. "But said to myself that if a tzaddik such as Rabbi Bomberger prays here, surely it's inappropriate for me to raise questions. I was called up for an aliyah, and I went up again, saying to myself that if a tzaddik like Rabbi Bomberger," he hadn't met Rabbi Bomberger yet, or apparently he's going to meet him for the first time, but he came to shul. "But if a tzaddik such as Rabbi Bomberger allows himself to be called up to the Torah in this synagogue, surely I can do likewise." I guess the parallel would be, you go to a shul, you're in a town, there's a nice big rav there, and you show up in a town, and lo and behold, the machitza is a tiny little nothing machitza. And but you see the rabbi is there, and the rabbi is called up, so if it's good enough for the rabbi, maybe that's the sort of argument people could make. "As we left the synagogue, the Würzburger Rav said to me, 'I am certain that there must be questions you wish to raise about my synagogue practices.' 'Heaven forbid,' I replied," Rabbi Salant says. "'If you approve of it, then it's not appropriate for me to raise any questions.' Nevertheless," Rabbi Bomberger said to him, "'I know that you were surprised to see me officiate in a clerical robe and in a synagogue where the Al-Maimar, the Bima, was not positioned properly. Let me assure you, I do not do so out of my own free will. The dissension caused by the innovators in our community threatened either to render it asunder or to lead it entirely into the Reform camp. I concluded that without concessions, I would not be able to save Torah Judaism in Würzburg. I would have to make concessions in non-essential issues. And he says they consulted with Rabbi Abraham Bing, who was his predecessor, who was quite elderly, who gave his consent. In other words, Rabbi Bomberger was faced with the fact that if he didn't make this concession, if he didn't wear the garb, and also what they did is they built the synagogue during the end, as I recall, the end of Rabbi Bing's rabbinate. And when he comes in, they were still building it, and they had decided they're putting the bima in the front, and they weren't going to listen to him. So what was he going to do? Declare that the synagogue is pasul and he's not going to daven there? They'll say, fine, Rabbi Bomberger, we'll hire another rabbi. They'll hire a liberal rabbi. They'll hire a rabbi from the Frankel School or something to do it. So you have to then sometimes look what's most important, a small violation. If the community was insisting that he wear the clerical garb, and if he refuses to, and they're going to say, what, you're better than everyone else, we'll get a different rabbi. He felt that he could lose the community. They'd hire a liberal rabbi. So we all know rabbis sometimes have to make compromises. It's not the best thing, but he felt he had to, and that's why he did it. Then he goes, Rabbi Salant says that he said he spent 3 days fasting and prayer, struggling with his conscience. But when he concluded that sounds a little bit hagiographical. I don't know if he fasted all this time. What does he need to fast for? If he asked Rabbi Bing and Rabbi Bing said to do it, but whatever. When he cleared his conscience and he said, we need to do these concessions. And because of that, I was able to stem the reform tide. And Rav Shmuel Salant says to him, there was no need to justify your behavior. You're one of the Gedolim. I don't need to raise it. But this has a postscript, because Rav Salant says, when he returned to Jerusalem, the rabbis there were going to issue a ban against all shuls, a ban for the whole world, that all shuls that didn't have a bima in the middle. You can't enter it, just like the Hungarian rabbis did. He says, as soon as I heard about it, he raised his voice in opposition, saying, this is Rabbi Salant says, I have seen one of the greatest tzaddikim in our generation, Rabbi Bomberger, praying in such a synagogue. I myself prayed in his synagogue and even allowed myself to be caught up for the aliyah. Clearly, it would be impudent for anyone to ban what he permitted. So Rabbi Salant said he shut down this ban, because if you're going to say now you can't enter a shul, Rabbi Bomberger's shul, fine, you build a new shul, you don't do it. It's best not to do it. But to say that a shul like that is forbidden, absolutely not. And so there we see that although he maybe wasn't happy with it, but he wore the garb. He understood that in Germany, that's what you have to do. But look, he was not a compromiser in dealing with reform. On the contrary, I'll give you a couple examples now. But here's an example of where it's not reform as much as it's Orthodox Jews, traditional Jews, who want to adopt new practices, which are not technically violations of halacha, but go against the Masorah, the tradition. So you had to weigh, in a case like that, you can either stand your ground, but then you can lose everything. Or you can make a little compromise on areas that are not absolute, and you can succeed. And look, we've spoken in previous classes. Rabbi Soloveitchik was willing to compromise even on mechitza for the rabbi, not for the individuals. The shul doesn't have a mechitza. You could take it, because otherwise we'll lose the shul completely to the non-Orthodox, which shows you that maybe the example I gave before is not a good example, because you can't say just because this big rabbi is a rabbi in a shul without a mechitza, you can then go daven there, because look, the rabbi is davening there, because you have to know in that case, the rabbi is the only one who's given permission. And no one else is given permission. So, but what do I mean that he wasn't a compromiser? Well, just give you a couple of examples. And Hamburger mentions this as well. There was someone in the community, obviously not an Orthodox Jew, but he's the Rav of the whole community. So you had people who weren't so observant also, refused to circumcise his son. Rabbi Bomberger suggested turning to the government to have the government force him to be circumcised. I don't know. In other words, say if you convert to Christianity, you circumcise your son. Again, I don't know what type of punishment. Maybe they allow the community to issue a fine or something, but you're in a community. You're in a Jewish community. If you want to be convert, then you don't have to circumcise. But as long as you're in a community, you need to. He also said that those who are not circumcised cannot be buried with everyone else in the cemetery. They have to be buried in a separate section where all the sinners are. He further, this was a big dispute, but the German rabbis were all in agreement, as far as I know, other than Ratz Hirsch Kalischer, who's also in Germany, but really he's more of like a Eastern European type of person. What all these men, Jewish men, are marrying non-Jewish women and are having children? They want to circumcise the children because in their mind they can't stand to look at their son, their baby child, without a bris milah. Now, true, the kid's not Jewish, but these people, for them, in their mind, that's enough. If they're circumcised, they're Jewish. Are you allowed to do this? Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer ruled, yes, you can absolutely circumcise them. First of all, it's going to make it easier in the future. They can convert, and they want to wear a bris milah. But also, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer develops this idea based on a mystical notion that they're Zerei Yisrael, that they have a Jewish essence, I guess, to them, even though they're not halachically Jewish. And we can't treat them like non-Jews, and we want to keep them close, and we will circumcise them now, and hopefully later we'll be able to convert them. Rav Israel Hildesheimer rejected this idea. Rav Bamberger also rejected this idea. This David Ellenson, the late David Ellenson, has a very nice article about this whole dispute, because it became a well-known dispute because in America there was a Rabbi Bernard Illowy, the greatest halachic authority in America. I think at this time he was in New Orleans. That's where he spent a number of years. You had people in America who wanted this, and Rav Illowy banned the Moharim, said the Moharim cannot do this, and he wanted to get support, so he wrote to Europe, and there was discussion among the rabbis in Europe, and I think today everyone is in agreement, as far as I know, today, all the great poskim, that you cannot circumcise someone who's, if you're not going to convert them. You can't just circumcise them, because then, or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they don't all say that. The reason they all give is that it creates a problem, because in Europe, who was circumcised? Or in America, only Jews were circumcised. So here you're going to circumcise this kid, but you're not converting him. He's going to grow up thinking he's Jewish because he's circumcised, and he's going to marry a Jewish woman. But today, lots of people are circumcised. I don't know if it's the same thing. And in the Muslim world, the Muslims are circumcised also. So it's not the same issue, really. So I don't know what the Sephardi poskim has said, but the Ashkenazic poskim, as far as I know, other than Ratz Hirsch Kalischer, are basically all lined up in this position. And there's other, Adam Furziger in his book, he cites a number of other relevant responses. We don't need to go through all of them, just in the interest of time, about where. He comes out very strongly against reform, even saying you have to, if the reformers are not following halacha, you have to create a separate cemetery from the reformers. And then, what else can I tell you? Okay. By the way, when the reformers published a translation of the Torah, he organized an Orthodox translation of the Torah. What I want to do, although we'll have to do this next class. Next class is the last class. We're going to finish with Rabbi Bamberger. We'll talk about some stuff about Minhagim. He had some interesting Minhagim. Shadal, the famous commentator, what he said. Oh, some interesting things we'll get to, and we'll conclude. And maybe some stuff I have still stacked up, but I'll just say today one more thing. I don't know if we have any psychologists. Erich Fromm, the famous psychologist, is actually, I don't know if anyone knows this, a direct descendant of Rabbi Bamberger. His grandmother was the daughter of Rabbi Bamberger. We'll have one, let me take the questions though, but we will have one more class with the great Rav Zalman Bar Bamberger. And then, as I said, we're going to move into a fascinating topic, the Musar dispute. It's so fascinating because today, well, people would wonder, why would there be a dispute? What's wrong with learning Musar? Isn't that a great thing? It's like saying, dispute over learning Gemara. Isn't Musar something we all need to work on? So we will see that matters are more complicated, as they always are. Someone asked me which publisher, Littman Library. That's my book. Ellie says, a close friend scholar translated Hirsch's formal German into understandable language 2 years ago. He wanted me to translate to English, but his publisher would not permit, as they wanted people to purchase older translations. I would still love to translate Hirsch for American Jewish consumption. Well, what I can say is that there is no copyright on Hirsch's published writings. They've all copyright is all Wayne's. So anyone who wants to try a new translation, we have three translations of the 19 letters. We have Drachman, and then we have Then we Jacob Breuer did like an updating one, and then we have the Elias one. But that's a free for all if anyone wants to translate it from the original. Leia says that you ever may appell Sefer Achinuch book and the first volume of Complete Code of Jewish Law. Ah, yes. Well, he wrote Rabbi Appel is I just actually the rabbi of my shul's son married Reb Gershon Appel's great granddaughter. So I was at the wedding 2 weeks ago, and I had met on the Shabbos of the Ufruf. Well, he listens to the classes, so if I'm not live, the grandson of who created the website Gershon Appel Blogspot or whatever it's called, and then I met Rabbi Gershon Appel's son. Rabbi Gershon Appel's other son, Yaakov Appel, was my Rebbe in elementary school. Unfortunately, he died. He had a brain tumor. He died before he was even 40, I think. It was a terrible, terrible story, Rabbi Yaakov Appel. But Rabbi Gershon Appel, later in life, published two volumes, Concise Code of Jewish Law, where it's like a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch with all the like modern shaylos at the bottom. And one of them has an interesting two-page note of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik on it, but it's like an anthology of Shelos HaTshuvos. Someone privately says the Minag Ashkenaz Mufak on Rosh Hashanah is a daven early and finish before Chatzos. But the question is, do they have a break in the middle? We're at no break. So
no break. Period.
I'm not sure why. What was the big advantage, though, to wake up 6:30? They'd start like in Hungary, 6:30 shacharis, and then they take a break. Why wake up 6:30? Just off at 8 o'clock. But in Israel sometimes, and the Sephardim, the Syrians, and I was once there for Shabbos. I was speaking there, and we started like 6:45 a.m. Shabbos morning. And we finish early, and then they sit around and they lecture and this, but it's not for me. Chaim says in Muncie,
the joke used to be we don't only read the piyutim. You mean the page numbers too.
In Muncie, any Haredi shul I've seen with a gallery is a full height partition at the edge of the gallery using curtains. Well, that's the old Hungarian approach, the Hasidic approach. That was not the approach in Lithuania. They never were so stringent on this. And look, it's the classic response of Moshe Feinstein and all the modern Orthodox, and not just modern Orthodox shuls, that you can see the women. Of course, the machitzas now are a little taller than they used to be, but you can still see. Someone privately says the choir doesn't repeat the words or sentences. Hungary had Meshorim. What's the difference in Meshorim and a choir? I don't know. You can elaborate for us, someone? Naftali, how do you differentiate in Meshorim and a choir?
I'll send you an email on that.
Okay, we'll clarify for next week.
It's in the public
German
room.
Style
choir
has
an article on it.
Okay, the German-style choirs were absolutely no good. Okay, but he says that it doesn't repeat the words. I can tell you that in Basel is a German Orthodox Nusach, Minhag, and they do repeat the words, and they have been repeating the words for 150 years. So, everybody says the Hungarians are always extreme. Okay, it is true. It is true that there's a lot of extremism in Hungary, and it's a question of why. I once discussed with Professor Twersky. He asked me what I thought. Why the Hungarians, you have such extremism? But it's not all of Hungary. In the western part of Hungary was not so much. But yes, they were. There was a lot of extremism there. Not repeating words seems to be important. You say that's why singing all of Kedusha is frowned upon. In the modern Orthodox, there's no problem singing along with Kedusha. As long as the words are not repeated. And Cohen says in Lithuania, repeating words of davening was avoided. Well, the Aruch HaShulchan, we see he's opposed to it, but he says the Chazanim like to do it. And he doesn't see a problem. Like let's say you have Hislavus, and you say, like in davening, you say, Modi, Modi, we know you can't repeat. The Aruch HaShulchan says it. The Gemara already says that because it could be a dualistic system. But let's say let's say you have you're inspired in the davening and you just, Hamelech, Hamelech. You know, well, the Aruch HaShulchan doesn't think that that's technically a problem, and Ramosha doesn't either, because you're not changing anything. It's not a hefsek. We know it's not a hefsek. If it's part of davening, it's not a hefsek. All the piyutim. How can we put these piyutim into the middle of Shmon Esrei? Isn't that a hefsek? No, it's not a hefsek. It's a part of davening. So if you're inspired in it, I could show you, send you some videos of the Rebbe of Tosh. The Rebbe of Tosh, boy, he would repeat. He'd repeat five, 10 times. He'd repeat. But if, you know, if it's part of, if it's not a show, and you're not a performer, if you're doing it as part of the feeling. Look, I can tell you that there was a rabbi, not from the modern Orthodox, in my town, who was also a chazan, and he would repeat. And I asked him once about this, and this is what he explained, basically, that his repeating is not the sort of repeating that the post-scheme are opposed to. Yes, the Breuer show always had a choir, but all the big shows in Germany had choirs. So there was... that was dignified. You go to England today. Many shows have choirs. Yes, and M.J. Frankel, choir shows are one of the prohibitions. Yes, Michalowicz, which I mentioned, that's what I was referring to. They came up with, 9 decrees. One of them is that you can't see the bride. Well, not the bride. One is you can't see the women in the shul. The other is you can't have a wedding in a synagogue. If you come to Hungary with me this summer, you'll see. To this day, the chuppah is always outside. But there's another one that you can't have a choir shul. The rabbi can't wear the gown. You can't preach in the vernacular. So Rav Israel Hildesheimer deals with all these things. Yes, that was in Michalowicz. You are correct, Ellie. Hirsch believed in clerical garb to generate respect. But in other words, that's what the people wanted. That was considered respectful, dignified. So that's why they weren't. And Cohen says, in the Orthodox shul in Rome, the chazan and maybe rabbi wore clerical robes. They still wear clerical robes in Rome. They still wear it. It's a, but it doesn't look like the Protestant ministers or the Catholic. It's like their own garb, and they have a hat. So I don't know if that's a direct. Okay, and finally, Ellie says
prohibition of repetition. The Hallel itself repeats verses. I wonder what that dates to.
Yeah, the Hallel does repeat the verses, and no one says it's a problem because it's in the Seder it repeats, but they would have a problem if you repeated yourself, you know, once it's in the Nusach of the Seder. But you're right, if it was a problem, so are we going to say it's a problem if we repeat? Ramosha, like I said, didn't see a problem technically, although they don't like it, because once you start repeating, then who knows what it leads to. But it's not a technical halachic violation if you just repeat the same word. Other than modi, modi. The Gemara says you can't say that. Now, the Jewish Center, we spoke in the past about the Bima and the Jewish Center, and Spanish and Portuguese, the formal clerical garb, yes, in Australia. All the high church synagogues, still, if we can call them that, still have these things. Let me quickly look through if there's any last comments. Naftali says that there are certain individuals who heard Chazan, is that Shavai or Shvei, who repeated, that's the Chazan in Breuer's?
No, what was called the Washington Heights Synagogue, Rabbi Weinberg.
Washington Heights Synagogue, yeah. Yes, and someone points out that Rabbi Gershon Appel's nephew is Yehuda Mirsky, who wrote the wonderful book on Rav Kook. Appel, Chavatzelet, Mirsky, they were all related to each other. Yeah, and all from this old Hebraic type of stuff. I got from the family, actually. There was a big machokas out in Seattle about the mikvah when he was the rabbi there, because the mikvahs in America in many places used to use the faucets, regular city water. And there was a big Talmud Chacham out there named Baruch Shapiro, and he had mottled it, but it's not that he mottled it. This is how it was done. This is actually how it was done in many places as well. And when the Helmetzer, who was the one who redid all the mikvahs in America, he made a big thing about it, became a huge machokas. So, The family has some material about this, so hopefully I'll write a little bit about this. And someone privately says that he was a Satmar Chassid, this Chazan. Hey, okay, well, the Satmar Chassid was repeating the words, but I bet you he wasn't skipping, like I said. And I bet you it was just the individual words or something, but I could be wrong about that. But that skipping it, Ramosha says, is an absolute violation, because then you're changing the matbeya, the form of the verses. But if you just repeat a word in, let's say, in a verse in Shemona Esrei, you repeat, you say, tikanta Shabbas, ratzika, karbonaseh. That's technically not a violation, according to their Shulchan and Ramosha. Okay, thank you all for coming out. One more class on Rabbi Bamberger. Rabbi Kelman.
Yeah, of course. The Rav, of course, as we all know, is very much opposed to sort of congregational singing with the chazan. You know, what we all do. He was opposed. I don't think anybody would enjoy davening, whatever, the way he was very, very strict about that, as you know. Anyway.
But that wasn't, the Young Israel came up with this movement because we need to keep people involved.
100%.
In Europe, the masses didn't sing along.
As you mentioned, Hungary was our first trip in Torah Moshe in 2011. And the first Shabbos, I turned to Mark and looked, I said, I can't take this stumbling. It's like unbelievable. It's like the way it goes on. And Mark just said to me, now you know why they started, you know, German Orthodoxy. I remember that conversation so clearly from 13 years ago. And please God, we'll be back in Budapest this summer. And everybody is welcome. That really is our first, it's original trip. It's really very powerful trip from Jewish history. People would like to go. I just saw an email about it because actually the early bird special expires this week. We have to already pay hotels and everything and et cetera. So if you're interested in going, there really is this is like this class on steroids 100 times over. Mark, is that a fair comment? Like,
indeed it is. And it, know, it is.
It's this class on steroids. Yeah. So really there's so much to see on that trip. Anyways, but thank you. And you would have enjoyed the class today with Yosef Lindell on he did the Adler Machzor and some of the issues sort of you alluded to, he discussed with the Piyutim, of course, went to skip them, and we say way less Piyutim.
You know, I have unpublished stuff which I found in the Chief Rabbinate Archives from Rabbi Adler. His permission, everyone knows because it's recorded, he gave permission, but I have his actual writings, his permission for deleting certain piyutim, and interesting.
That's an American thing. We deleted all the piyutim, or many of the piyutim, but anyways. All right, everybody, we should be well and hear good news. And tomorrow, of course, Rabbi Shulman's class on Kohelet and all the regular classes during the week. Rabbi Shulman actually will also be giving the Parshas here this week, so he'll be on twice this week. You don't normally come to his Kohelet class. They can come here in my Parsha on Thursday night. And like I say, please invite your friends. I'm sure you also saw that we're doing in 2 weeks, February 11th, we're having, I don't know what you want to call it, a whole day on resilience and challenging time, having a number. Really, it's really, I think, some great experts in the field, unfortunately, with everything going on. So issues about coping, and I sent out the schedule earlier, I think last night or today. If you want to take a look, that's going to be like from 9:15 to about 2:15 on Sunday, February 11th, before the Super Bowl. I know that's the big American Yontif, but anyway, so that'll be in 2 weeks, and powerful program, I believe, and you can look at some wonderful speakers. Anyway, everybody should be well, and they're good things. Okay, Lilo to everybody. Okay, bye-bye.
Toda rabba.
Bakasha. Bakasha, Lilo Tov.
Kol Tov.
Kol Tov.